Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts,
SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. The United States has reclaimed
SoundCloud
the world's oil crown. Growth in oil production in Texas and the Permian and Bakken geological regions. They have now put U.S. total oil production ahead of Russia for the first time since 1999. You can credit technology, the shale revolution, and lots of money with this advancement. Here to tell us more about it is Bethany McLean, the author and contributing editor to Vanity Fair, and the author of a new book entitled Saudi America, The Truth About Fracking and How It's Changing the World. Bethany, thank you very much for coming in. Just start off by explaining to people what you learned as you made all of the investigations to do this book, because there have been a lot of headlines about fracking, the shale revolution, the technology. What did you find out after you did all of your investigational work?
So the thing that obsessed me, the question that obsessed me, was how it could be true that fracking could be changing the world. And it is. It's reshaping geopolitics. You just saw the numbers you cited. But that the industry doesn't make money, that it's on this shaky financial footing. And how could both things be true at once? And so that's the question I set out to answer. I guess what I learned, I came to this broader realization that this whole concept of energy independence, which has been pushed by every president since the 1970s, is this exalted grand goal we needed to achieve, that it's somewhat of a fraud today. It doesn't make sense as a broad goal.
I have to wonder, you wrote the first skeptical article about Enron back in 2001. Of course, Enron collapsed under accounting fraud. Is there something that is similar about the way that the shale story is being told today?
It's an interesting question. I suppose there's a certain lack of transparency in shale, but I think you can figure it out if you delve into the details. I actually think it might be the opposite, and that the problems with the industry are right there on the surface. It's pretty easy to tell that the industry doesn't make any money. It's just that it's not something we want to take into account as we think about it.
Yeah, so it's so interesting. We've been talking about this. I used to cover debt markets very, very closely, and we were talking about just this explosion of shale debt that got absolutely punished in 2014, 2015, 2016. And now people are saying, well, the existing companies are in good shape because it was sort of, you know, this was like a sort of a sweep of all the bad ones, and the ones that are remaining are strong and healthy. Do you think that's true, or do you think there still is a lot of fragility?
I think there's some truth to it, but the wipeout wasn't what it would have been because Wall Street was there. Wall Street remained willing to finance these companies. Banks remained willing to restructure debt. Part of that has to do with the dynamics that are keeping the industry going, which is the flood of pension fund money into private equity firms and credit hedge funds, and the credit hedge funds then invested in the distressed debt of these energy companies. So the money was still there. It didn't go away. And I think the final answer to what you just said is that the industry still isn't making money. The most recent analysis I saw was a Wall Street Journal analysis. I think it was either the first or the second quarter of 2018 that only five companies produced positive cash flow.
Energy companies that specialize in fracking, they're valued on how much acreage they have, right? How much acreage they have plus how much production they have, not on how profitable they are. How did we get there?
So people have been willing to fund shale based on this belief that it's going to be profitable one day. And so in the absence of real profits, they've come up with other ways to value it, which has been multiples of acreage, looking at production growth. To me, it's very reminiscent of the first dot-com boom, when dot-com companies were valued as a multiple of eyeballs, because in the absence of traditional measures of profitability, if you want to value things, you have to turn to non-traditional measures of
valuation. And you have to find something that's positive,
and you have
right?
to find something that's positive, right? But that's enabled this whole mechanism to work, and it's too cynical to call it a daisy chain, but it's meant that you can build, private equity can fund a fracking company and take it public or sell it to an already public company, and everybody can make money, but that or extract money along the way, but that doesn't mean in the end that the industry is making money.
The industry's net debt in 2015 was $200 billion. That's a 300% increase from 2005. This is according to some Columbia University professor's statistics that you cited in a recent story that you wrote for the Times, for the New York Times. I'm just wondering, can you fast forward for us? What is the consequence of the fact that these private equity and private debt funds are financing an industry that is held up with great esteem from a policy perspective, but has not made any money?
So I think there are two answers to that. One is a financial answer, and it worries me. Pension funds around the country are in dire shape. They, in the absence of any returns in traditional fixed income markets, they've started putting their money into private equity firms. If the returns aren't there at the end of the day, and if the daisy chain stops in the private equity portfolios, that's problematic for pension funds around the country. And that's a real issue, given that they are underfunded anyway. I think the broader question, though, is sort of more of an existential one, even beyond the financial repercussions of this, which is that we're beating our chest about energy independence and how great it is that we're now the biggest producer of oil ahead of Russia and Saudi Arabia. But what does that really mean if there's a risk to production if the capital dries up? And energy is the foundation of national security. Wars have been won and lost based on access to energy. It's incredibly important. And I don't like seeing short-term policy in the absence of long-term thinking.
Just to pick up on the figure, Lisa, that you mentioned, the $200 billion worth of debt that has been raised in order to support the fracking industry. Based on your research, would that $200 billion be better served if it was spent investigating new sources of renewable energy?
That is a really hard question to answer, because I do think that unleashing our supply of oil and natural gas has had some positives. It's given us leverage. It gives Europe leverage in negotiating with Russia over its supply of natural gas. I think that natural gas is actually more real than oil is. It's more economically viable than producing oil is. And so there's some really good things about this. But one other thing I was really struck by in doing this book were the number of smart investors I talked to who are not investing in oil and gas anymore, because the age of renewables is coming. The only question is when. And once we know the answer to when, the price of oil will go into a secular decline and never recover. That's what happened with coal. And so for us to fall behind in the race to develop renewables is for us to look at the world as it is and not the world as it's going to be, and perhaps cede American leadership in the world of the future.
Bethany McLean, thank you so much for coming in. Really fascinating. Bethany McLean is an author and contributing editor at Vanity Fair. Her new book is Saudi America, The Truth About Fracking and How It's Changing the World. And she was the one who wrote the first skeptical article about Enron. I just want to bring you some breaking headlines. Goldman Sachs confirming Stephen Scherr as chief financial officer, also saying that they are going to name John Waldron as president. This according to the Wall Street Journal. We will bring you more throughout the day as that unfolds. Coming up, Bloomberg Politics, Policy, Power, and Law. I'm Lisa Abramowitz, along with my co-host Pim Fox, and this is Bloomberg.
Commercial banking in the United States, particularly in the northeastern regions, is our focus. And Don McCree is the vice chairman and the head of commercial banking for Citizens Financial Group. They're based in Providence, Rhode Island. But Don joins us here in our 1130 studios. Don, I got to ask, you're a 30-year veteran of J.P. Morgan, right?
That's right.
What caused you? What is Citizens Bank? For a lot of people don't know about Citizens Bank. They know about maybe the changes that went on inside the banking industry in general. But tell us about Citizens Bank and why you decided that this is where you want to hang your hat.
So Citizens Bank has been around for a very long time. In recent years, it was part of Royal Bank of Scotland, a big British bank, which actually experienced difficulty in the financial crisis. It ultimately resulted in Citizens Bank going public about 4.5 years ago. When I looked at the situation at Citizens, what I saw was an exciting opportunity to be part of a ground floor build of a brand new independent financial institution. The strategy we've been employing and the strategy that was exciting to me is a growth strategy. It's an expansion strategy in terms of client base. It's an opportunity to deploy what has been a very healthy level of capital. And it really was an opportunity to provide a service level to clients that we think is quite different and quite differentiating.
It's an interesting time to be in banking right now. I'm just thinking about yesterday's Global Financial Services Conference hosted by Barclays in New York, and it did create a lot of concern that perhaps there wouldn't be the same kind of loan growth going forward that there has been in the past, and this could be a headwind to profitability. What's your take on that?
So I think the topic of loan growth has been in the forefront for several quarters and maybe several years now. There was a lot of optimism coming off the tax cuts that the administration rolled out almost a year ago now, and a lot of expectation that loan growth would be quite robust. It's been relatively benign. We actually have been growing much quicker on the loan line than most of the competition, and that's been a result of geographic expansion and client expansion. And
do you have to lower standards as a result?
No, you know, we really haven't. And I think one of the things that every banker will always balance is that question of credit and structure and terms and loan growth. And we have a very disciplined process at the bank, and we pass on a lot, and yet we've been able to grow. So I think what you heard out of Barclays yesterday is a continuation of a theme, which is a real question around how quickly loans are going to continue to grow in the marketplace.
Speak about mergers and acquisitions and how companies face the issue of whether they're going to grow organically or whether they're going to make acquisitions, and also about the abundance or lack thereof of suitable candidates at a suitable value.
So that's a incredibly interesting story for us. I was on one of your shows about 6 months ago talking about an acquisition that we did, which was a company called Western Reserve Partners, which is a middle market oriented mergers and acquisition firm. And just to baseline, our client base is about three quarters middle market private companies, or maybe some a little bit less than that. And our M&A practice is really aimed at both the private equity firms and those mid-sized companies. Now, in the mid-sized company space, there is extremely robust M&A right now. And what really drives it is the opportunity to grow, as you say, expand someone's business by combining with a like-kind company. But it's often a change of control transaction where a private family is selling out of their ownership position. We see a very robust pipeline in our business, and we, in fact, do a survey every year of CEOs of our client base, and it kind of spiked at the highest it's ever been in terms of desire to transact,
really,
both buy and sell. Now, M&A obviously takes a long time. It's a, you know, often a year-long process as a company prepares and then sells itself. But what we see in our business is a lot of activity, and our pipelines are quite strong.
You said there's a lot of competition. And for your business, given the clients that you are targeting, who is your biggest competition?
It's everybody. Non-banks and large banks.
Well, I mean,
and
private equity firms, in other words? Because if you're targeting...
No. So think about loan funds, non-bank providers of loan capital.
So direct lending
funds.
Yes,
yep, absolutely. And you know, I've been in this business, as you guys said, for 35 years. There has always been robust competition. And it comes in various forms and sizes at different points in the cycle. But I think you can always combat competitive environments by providing high quality service and attention to clients.
Is this time different somehow?
No, I really don't think so. I think what is a little bit different is there is a lack of demand, as you said, for capital in the form of loans across the board. So new money financing has been running relatively low for many years now. So there's a supply and demand disequilibrium, which is basically creating a more intense competitive environment.
Speak, if you can, a little bit about the lending that you're doing, particularly when it comes to real estate. I note, for example, the chocolate factory in Mansfield, in Mass. You've been loaning money also for affordable housing projects.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that side of the business.
So our real estate business is a little over 10% of our overall business right now. I was actually with real estate clients in Washington, D.C. yesterday. Our approach to real estate is really twofold. One is, as you say, we do a lot of community lending around our community reinvestment activities, and that's a big part of every bank's activities. And then in our mainstream real estate business, our approach is really to select very strong sponsors and very strong developers and travel with those developers across the country. So we've been expanding our real estate in different parts of the country, and it's a business we quite like. There's a little bit of pressure right now given tariffs and the cost of raw materials, but the feedback I got, at least in the D.C. area yesterday, was quite strong.
Thank you so much for being with us. We'll have to have you back in to talk about the confidence and why there hasn't been more demand for loans from the private sector. Don McCree, Vice Chairman and Head of Commercial Banking at Citizens Financial Group in Providence, Rhode Island, but he made the trek down here to New York in our 1130 studios here at Bloomberg. I'm Lisa Abramowitz, along with my co-host, Pim Fox. This is Bloomberg Markets.
The Turkish Central Bank raises overnight repo rates to 24% in order to forestall a decline in the value of the Turkish lira. Here to tell us more about emerging market assets and the ramifications is Vincent Signorella, our global market strategist for Bloomberg. He joins us here in our 1130 studios. Vincent, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Is this going to be enough to forestall continued declines in value of the Turkish lira, 24%? I mean, come on, who's kidding who? This is window dressing, no?
Always a pleasure as well, Pim. No, it's not so much window dressing. This is actually very calming for the markets. There was concern that the central bank would back off under pressure from President Erdogan, who previously made a statement that rates should be going down, not up, and actually threw the market a curveball with that one. And then essentially, we had a consensus, a very loose consensus for 350 basis points. So this move to this level is calming for the moment. The real question is going to come in the future when inflation begins to pick up again. Will the central bank respond in the future? Because 24%, which obviously sounds high to us, didn't sound high to me in the 80s, though.
Yeah, but, you know, I want to go exactly to what you just said. What was that all about with Erdogan coming out and saying they should drop rates? And then just hours, minutes after that, the central bank came out and said that they were raising rates.
Yeah, I can't honestly go into what the president of Turkey was thinking at the moment.
Go into his mind.
No, I'm not going to.
All right, well, what I do want to ask you about is how much is this a turning point or a potential turning point for the entire complex of EM currencies? Because we are seeing a rally today, for example, in the South African rand, which a lot of people are pointing to as suffering the contagion effects of the Turkish lira falling out of bed. So is this sort of a sign Turkey is taking its currency crisis seriously and perhaps people will start to get a little more confident with emerging markets, or is that going too far?
I think confidence is probably a little too far. I think it's definitely a pause. Like you said, the ZAR is higher, up 1.2%, but we're still seeing pressure on the Argentine peso. That's down 1.2%. Brazil is off the lows of the day, but still down 0.3%. But we're definitely seeing a little bit of pressure backing off. It came back on a touch after Trump's tweet that the Wall Street Journal had it wrong, that we don't need to make a deal with China. China needs to make a deal with us. And some are basically looking at this. The situation with the tariffs is hard to believe if you want to bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States that these are going to be of a temporary nature. They need to be far longer and lasting. So that could continue to weigh and potentially continue to weigh on EM, I think.
Vincent, do you remember the movie Patton?
Yes.
Okay. Do you remember that scene where Omar Bradley, you know, he's arguing with George Patton and he says, you know, I can read a map. When you look at what Turkey just did, raising interest rates to 24%, at the same time that they are now requiring companies in Turkey in order to transact all of their business in Turkish lira, doesn't this mean that if you want to borrow money in Turkey, it now costs you a lot more? How does that help the underlying economy?
Well, it really doesn't help the underlying economy in the short term. What the hope is, and this is, you know, if you think back to the U.S. and our inflation situation in the 80s, the hope is actually to slow the economy. I mean, by slowing the economy, you slow inflation. The idea is you need to crush this very steep inflationary trend, even if it means to slow the economy down, because you can go back to lower rates to stimulate the economy in the future.
I understand that, but how is that going to make it possible for these companies to repay their dollar-denominated debts, and how is that going to make it possible for Turkish banks to continue to operate if they've extended all these loans to these Turkish companies?
Well, with the currency improving, it does help the dollar-denominated debt, because the depreciation in the currency is what affected that sovereign. And actually, as you mentioned, the corporations, that's a good point, because it's the corporate debt that's the issue in Turkey, not as much as the sovereign situation. So the local companies really did need a break with the currency in order to help repay that dollar debt. The question is, does it continue? The line, Goldman Sachs just put out a piece. They're looking at 599, and they say this is the 61.8 retracement from the highs of August 30th. So if we don't get back below the levels of basically 600, and we continue to hold there, the markets are likely to try the upside again and put some pressure on the government.
Vince, you're a former trader. You talk with a lot of traders. Mm-hmm. How many of them do you hear actually saying, all right, I'm going into Turkey?
No, not really.
You're like, none of them?
Not really that many. I mean, when you look at the overall picture, you know, the equity indexes that track emerging markets, they're better on the day, but still within a downtrend. A ticker that I like to look at is MXEF. That's up a touch on the day, not substantially. And
the MSCI Emerging
Markets
Index.
Yes, the MSCI Emerging Market Stock Index.
Yeah.
It's off the lows. It's taken a bit of a breather, but it's still in a nice down channel. So we really need a trend break.
A nice down channel. In other words, it's headed for more losses.
Yeah, I don't think unless we get... I don't think
that's
unless...
That's
a,
yeah, term.
A nice, yes. A nice down channel means someone's
down,
getting their face ripped 12% off.
It's down 12% this year.
There you go. Vincent
don't
Signorella.
Don't try to catch this one.
Vincent Signorella, thank you so much for joining us. As always,
my
we
pleasure.
Love having
you
on. Global market strategist for Bloomberg. A squawker on the other side, as well as a longtime trader who really has that perspective has had some very astute commentary over the past few months in particular. So thank you. Definitely looking at a little bit of a bounce, but it is far from calling game over on the sell-off in EM.
We turn our attention now to the land of groceries. Shares of Kroger down a little bit more than 9%. This is the biggest decline in 6 months. The supermarket chain missing analyst sales estimates. Margins also narrowing. Here to tell us all about it is Matthew Boyle, U.S. retail reporter for Bloomberg. And you can follow Matthew on Twitter at Biz Boyle. I like that. All right, Biz
Thank
Boyle.
Thank you. Please do.
What's going on at Kroger? I mean, you know, one day everything's great. They've got new alliances. They've got new joint ventures. You can order your groceries, pick them up at the store. They've got Simple Truth, I believe, the generic brand, that the store brand that's doing pretty well. What happened?
Well, they're doing a lot, but a lot of this is going to take time. You know, Pim, it's very high expectations. We're coming into this quarter. You saw what Walmart and Target did. They both had their best sales in more than a decade. So people were getting a little bit, you know, amped up. You know, it's a retail renaissance, and it just kind of shows how we go from, you know,
feast to famine.
Exactly. Feast to famine in retail here. But Kroger is doing a lot of the right things. They're remodeling stores. You know, they're doing deals in China with Alibaba. But, you know, these things are expensive. So that's why the margins are down.
So
and
this is what I'm wondering. I mean, are investors just simply short term in their view, and they don't view any of this as positive in the long run, even though this is exactly what Kroger ought to be
it's
doing?
It's a bit of an overreaction. And the company was frantically sort of, you know, qualifying it, saying, well, if you take out the impact of the store remodels, and if you take out the impact of the price cuts they had made, their same store sales would have been over 2%, which so would have beat, you know, beaten the street. But these days, you know, retail investors don't seem to, you know, have much patience for explanations like that. So it was a bit more pronounced. The share drop was a bit more than I had anticipated. But these days we're seeing share declines of 8 to 10%, even when companies beat estimates. So when you miss, you're going to get punished.
Do you hear from any analysts or any experts who tell you this is an opportunity to buy the stock of a company that's got, what, more than 2,700 actual grocery store outlets in 35 states? And also, they operate fine jewelry stores. That I did not know.
Yeah, I mean, they're all over the place. They own Turkey Hill. You know, they own, you know, food brands as well, though they're currently in the process of selling Turkey Hill. But Kroger is a very diversified, interesting company. They've got a huge percentage of their sales in their own brands, and that's very good for a retailer.
That's that Simple Truth?
Simple Truth and others, yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, they're saying their sales of Simple Truth were in, you know, double-digit gains this year, and that's very much, a good thing for any retailer, because store brands are way more profitable than, you know, the national brands like Kellogg and Campbell.
Although I will just push back a little bit. I mean, perhaps what investors are seeing is a company that is trying to spend so they can keep up with Amazon and the like, and Walmart, right, but it has just a smaller base to work from, and that if you have a smaller base at this point, even though they are behemoth, you could potentially be really hurt.
It's funny, yeah, to kind of say, well, Kroger's small. I mean,
exactly.
They're the largest traditional supermarket in the nation, but yet people look at them saying, what do you got? So it does kind of show, and it's not just Amazon, it's not just Walmart, it's Aldi and Lidl, remember, the German discounters on the low end, you know, biting and scraping and getting a little bit
Aldi.
Of market share.
Is Aldi, Aldi, yes. Aldi's one of those.
Yeah, Aldi and Lidl.
The hunts, you know, you go into an Aldi store, a Lidl store, and you go, wow, sausages right next to toasters.
I mean, but look at what they've done in the UK. It is quite impressive, and they want to do the same here.
It's so sad that that's what counts for the hunt these days for humans. It's like to go in, it's not to have a bow and arrow.
Well, I mean, Costco, I think, is an example of this.
Toaster.
Yeah. Costco right? is more of a treasure hunt. You know, where, you know, Aldi is a bit more of a, well, I'm hunting and look what I found, you know, a battery charger. But hey,
Who knew?
I needed one anyway. Let's pick it up.
Could you just expand? Because as I said, I really did not, I underestimated the jewelry business at Kroger.
Yeah.
They've got jewelry stores.
I mean, Kroger wants you to be going in there and, you know, all things to all people. If you don't expect to be finding it there in the same way that you don't expect to find, you know, high-end diamonds at a Costco. But, you know, it's there. And if it drives a trip, if it drives an experience, which is this buzzword in retail right now, you know, everybody wants shopping to be an experience. That's a, you know, a very good thing.
And yeah, from blueberries to diamonds.
Exactly.
It's a heck of a lot more profitable than
Frosted Flakes.
Yeah. Matt Boyle, thank you so much for being with us. Boyle is U.S. retail reporter for Bloomberg News.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.